meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order, and it's going to be moving as fast as we can. And Senator Coring's witnesses said we could do this thing in 10 minutes or less.
10 minutes? Five. I thought he told me five.
Okay.
I can do mine in three.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to hold up the whole show to have the bill in front of me.
Is it not in front of us?
We'll start by listening.
Okay.
Yes, why don't you start explaining the bill? We'll make sure it's available.
Mr. Chairman, this was something that I actually worked on this a couple years ago. The health department was kind of putting a burden on campgrounds, requiring that each campsite have a backflow. Isn't it a backflow protector? And it's quite expensive. And so we thought we had this worked out with the health department couple of years ago, and then it came back again, so that we figured we needed legislation to get this taken care of. And so I got a couple gentlemen here that'll explain what's going on, and I guess we've got it all everything worked out with the health department and everything, and shouldn't be any objections at all. So Mr. Chairman, I would just turn it over right now, if that's okay with you.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kevin Matzik. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. This bill is something that we've worked on with the Department of Health over the last 3 or 4 years. And what it does, actually, I believe there's an author's amendment.
We'll get that. That's okay. What we're waiting for right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That language of the author's amendment is language that we've worked on with the Department of Health that we've kind of all in agreement on. And what it does is it allows for it's a hose connection vacuum breaker backflow device as opposed to what's currently required by the plumbing code. And so that's just the language we've worked out with Department of Health on this issue. And I think all sides are in agreement on it, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm Wally Nice. I'm owner of South Isle Family Campground by Lake Mille Lacs and the current president of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. We're asked for your support on this issue. It's an issue that would cost the campground owners throughout Minnesota a tremendous amount of money and labor because the devices would not be able to be left on over winter months. We have to take them off and
And from understanding of those of us who aren't that familiar with it, the issue with RVs or whatever is hooking up to the machines, they all have the backflow prevent. They required to. You have to buy them that way. I mean, it's standard now.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. For the last 35 years, it's been a requirement in the RVs to have a backflow preventer built into the system. So the concern of when the RV is hooked up to the water supply, there's protection built into the RV to prevent any type of backflowage into the water supply.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just say, you know, this goes back to when I was dairy farming and was inspected twice a year by the Agriculture Department. All of my stock tanks had to have backflow protectors so that just in case the power went out, that the water that was in the stock tank did not siphon back into the well. And so I think that's what we're talking about, the same thing here. But this bill takes care of the problem, and it's all worked out. I don't know if there's anybody here from the health department, but he just gave the okay.
The health department is satisfied. The record reflects it's a thumbs up. Okay.
Yep.
And people are getting the bill as introduced. We actually have an amendment to it, and the House file is what will the amendment will put the bill in the same shape as the
yes.
House file. So basically, the amendment language is the House file.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the House file number?
Mr. Chairman, what is the amendment number?
It's A1, but it's drafted to Senate File 2111,
Okay.
We had a number of problems here because it's House File 2090. We had some problems with duplicating census 211 instead of 2111.
Okay.
And it is the House file which we have in front of us.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, what would be the correct motion?
What we will do is distribute the A1 amendment, which is the House file language, I believe.
Okay. We have it.
You have the A1 amendment?
No.
Yes. We have the bill. I don't have.
It should be in the packet, I'm told.
Behind the elections bill.
The 2111A1 council amendment is the House language, and if we put the number House file 2090 on top of that, that's what's in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Corrin, this is exempting recreational camping areas from having to install these?
No. No, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson. What it is it's letting them use a different type of backflow preventer, not the expensive one. They're using a different one. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's correct. It's only at the hose bib connection, so at the individual RV campsite where the recreational vehicle would hook up to the water supply, at that situation, we are exempting them from the more expensive type and allowing the amendment. It would allow the vacuum breaker backflow preventer.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Corrin, the way the bill reads, and if we get the amendment, it says that it is exempt.
Mr. Chair?
Do you have the A1 amendment in front of you?
No, I don't.
Oh, it should be in your packet. It's SCS 2111A1.
Okay, so now it says not rated for continuous use are permitted.
So in other words, the lesser quality ones are allowed at the individual spigots.
But Mr. Chair?
Senator Worgen.
Just to reiterate, too, it's almost like it's a double measure because all campers, as he said, in the last 35 years have this on the camper as well. So there is one on the camper, there's one on the faucet, and there's one at the main point. So, I mean, there's a lot of backup going on, and it's a good thing to do.
Mr. Chairman,
after
just putting a new bathroom in the lowest level of my house, I had to put one in the bathtub. Mm-hmm. So I guess they want them everywhere now.
And Mr. Chairman, I would point out that the ones that the health department was requiring were about $45 to $65, if it's my understanding. So if they had 100 campsites, you know, that's about $5,000. So that's a pretty good quite a burden on the campground. So.
I'm surprised they can define by law.
And the health department has indicated they're satisfied with the language here. They gave it a thumbs up. Because the tape didn't record that.
What's that?
Senator Corrin moved House File 2090, which is the language of the Delete All Amendment, be recommended, passed, and sent to the floor.
Yes.
Is there a discussion on that motion? Anybody else in the audience need to speak to this? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. How long is your bill going to take? Five?
Five is good.
Five or less. Senator Erickson Ropes, Senate File 1959. You have a delete everything amendment. You'd like to begin with that?
Oh, okay. Here's what the department was requiring, 41. And these are
Senator Erickson Ropes, you wish to delete everything?
Yes, please.
Senator Erickson Ropes moves the delete everything amendment, which is labeled SCS 1984A1. If there's any discussion, if not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be here today. To put this bill before you, all the counties in the state of Minnesota, I think, will be very happy to have this bill passed because it's going to save them tens of thousands of dollars. And being a nurse, I was particularly interested in this issue. It was brought to me by one of my county health nurses, and they do work in connection with the jails and jail population. As you may know, when someone is sentenced or held over in a jail facility, they have to turn over all their personal medications, and then the county system and jails have to request medications and buy them in through the county system for the patients or inmates while they're staying in the jails. And when the inmates are transferred or released, then often there's leftover medications. They're all individually bubble-wrapped and have been under lock and key the entire time that they have been there at the facilities, and yet they're not able to return those unused medications back to the pharmacies. And this bill would give them the opportunity to do that. And right now they're stuck with lots and lots and lots of medications, and they wind up spending or losing $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 a year on medications. So with that, I'll just lay the bill in front of you, and you'll start. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews, the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'll be very brief. Historically, jails have been allowed to enter new agreements with their local pharmacies to accept these return drugs under a variance issued by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Recently, last November, we were informed that they have had a change of heart and they're not going to be issuing those variances anymore. And so what this bill would do would allow counties to, in conjunction with their local pharmacies, enter into these voluntary agreements. We think it's a great idea. As Senator said, it does save money. The other thing is that it does is it allows the pharmacist to make the decision whether or not the drugs can be safely accepted and returned and reissued. We do think it's critical that we look at the cost issue. It is, in some counties, as high as $80,000 or $100,000. Statewide, we think it's about $2 million that it will cost. The board has indicated that they would like to see 24-hour, 7-day-a-week nursing coverage for any institution that's going to be returning drugs to a pharmacy. As a jail facility, clearly we don't have the same exposure to the public that a nursing home or assisted living facility might have. In those cases, that may be warranted, but our county folks are trained medical staff, and they are trained in how to dispense those drugs and store them properly. You can see in the bill that we do require that someone who is the handling of those medications be on hand 24 hours a day. It's just that they need not be an actual nurse. And with the nursing shortage we have in our state right now, counties simply can't find the staff and simply can't afford to hire those folks to fill that role for safety purposes. We have had no incidents in the past of any problems.
And Mr. Matthew, in terms of the pharmacist, are they the one that makes the final decision? In other words, if there's very heat-sensitive medication, they could reject it if they feel it's not safe.
Absolutely.
And if
welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, before Claudia speaks here, I'll just remind you that I put in front of you testimony from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and they also support this move.
Ms. Brewington, welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Claudia Brewington. I am the legislative liaison for Health and Human Services for MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this early, late afternoon, early evening, in regards to Senate File 1959. We had arranged originally for one of the public health directors from Winona County to come up and speak to the committee, but with the uncertainty of time, we weren't sure what time she would need to be here. So I am going to just take her testimony and kind of distill it down and give you the high points of that. Her name is Lynn Thur. She is the Winona County Community Health Services. She's also a master's level public health nurse, a licensed family and marriage therapist, and would be speaking today on behalf of MICA, AMC, and MAXA, and LPHA, and also the Sheriff's Association. The concern for the counties is that when somebody comes into the jails, They aren't sure how long they're going to be there. Typically, counties will order 30 days worth of medication, and it does come individually wrapped. This is a poor example. It's kind of tiny, of drugs that called blister packs that you can push the drugs out of, and you can tell when they've been tampered with. They certainly wouldn't accept this one. It's been in my purse for a while. So, but they can refuse to accept those drugs back. With 30 days supply, sometimes somebody comes into the jail and they're out in 3 or 4 days, so you have a considerable amount of drugs left over. If the jails could not return the drugs, what will happen is they will start going to a weekly order. They'll order 7 days rather than 30 days. So there's not just the cost of the drugs to consider. There's also the fact that there will be more administrative work for their staff and ordering drugs more often. The people that handle the drugs, the med techs in the jails, are trained. It costs the counties about $400 to train each one of those individuals, and they are trained according to rules promulgated by the Department of Corrections or the Department of Human Services. They are trained on how to handle and store the drugs, which are kept in a locked box at all times except when they are dispensed. The other thing is that drugs in jails are probably in one of the safest places because not only are the drugs locked up, so are most of the people. There are cameras in about every place in a jail, too, so there is there's a watchful eye in just about every square inch of a jail. So it is a place that it would be very hard to tamper with some of the drugs. Again, this is something that is very important to some of the smaller rural pharmacies who come to these agreements with their jails. The jails, if they are forced to not be able to return the drugs for credit, they may start looking at some cheaper alternatives, which might be some mail order kinds of things, and would take the local pharmacy out of the loop. At this point, they are working with their local pharmacies, and it's something that benefits the local communities as well. So we urge the committee to support this bill. I do have more information if you want it, but in respect of the committee's time, I'll stop there and stand for any questions.
Questions from the committee, or is there anyone in the audience who wanted to raise concerns? Senator Dow, there is us.
Thank
please
you,
come
Chair.
Up, sir, as soon as.
Senator Erickson Ropes, I guess I just for my clarification, in the county jails and juvenile correction facilities, those are just short-term stays, and so the drugs that they would be using are just maybe a 30 or 60 days. So there, I don't know, is there a shelf life on some of these drugs and things like that? And
To that question, we do have licensed nurses that work with the jails to make sure that the drugs are stored properly and that the proper dosages are issued. And in most cases, it depends on the issue of the patient. Whatever their medical needs are, we have to provide the county jail. So, I mean, it just depends on what specific circumstances they have. I guess I don't know if I'm answering your
question. Senator Dowd, anybody over a year sentence goes to state prison. If it's less than a year,
my question is, Mr. Chair, is about the shelf life on these drugs. I guess if you're returning them, you know, I don't know how often you get them in, and just so that you're not returning drugs that are
expired
beyond their expiration date.
Senator Dahl, that's where the pharmacist has the discretion to refuse to accept the drugs or accept them and not reissue them. It's up to the pharmacist and the nurse to make the decision about whether or not these drugs are past the shelf life and there's procedures in place for them.
All right, thank you.
Further questions? Not, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I'll try to be brief here. I'll start off with a little bit of history about this issue. Back when I first started pharmacy school 25 years ago, the only facilities from which a medication could be returned and redispensed to the patient were licensed nursing facilities with nursing staff on duty 24/7. With a consultant pharmacist that came in at least monthly to check the storage conditions of the medications, with board-approved unit dose packaging, not just any unit dose packaging, but that met the board standards, and we rely on what's called the USP, or United States Pharmacopeia Standards. I've only been with the board for about 18 months. I'm told by my staff that approximately 6-7 years ago, something like that, the board started getting its first variance request to allow returns and redispensing of medications from other than nursing homes. At first, the board agreed to do that by variance to allow that for assisted living facilities that were, in essence, acting like nursing homes that had nurses on staff Same conditions, board approved unit dose packaging, monthly checks by the pharmacist. Somewhere along the line, the board did issue some variances to allow jails to do this. However, approximately 2.5 years ago, the board started work on the largest package of rule changes we've had since 1999. We're just about to finish that process. We had two advisory committees meet to consider all these rules. We had many meetings before the board itself. We had a hearing before an administrative law judge last November 14th, where the counties did testify in favor of the board trying to amend the rules to include them. All along the way, basically, the board prevailed in its opinion as to what the rules ought to be. We do think that there are some safety concerns. Anytime a medication is handled, anytime additional processes are added, you add a safety concern. We do want to have the medications in facilities where there is a licensed professional that has, several years of training rather than more minimal training to make sure that those drugs are always stored properly, that if something is not stored properly, people remove that from the system right away. And that may happen in jails. We don't know. The way that the bill is currently written, it would actually allow medications to be returned from jails at a lower standard than the board is currently requiring for nursing homes. There's no mention that it has to be unit dose packaging. There is no mention of monthly pharmacist checks of the facility, medication storage areas. So from the board's opinion, as a matter of safety, this is going backwards from the standards we have established. Returning medications from anywhere is a very controversial thing nationwide. There are some pharmacies and some other state boards that flat out don't allow returns, period, of any sort of medications because of the fact that once you start reprocessing the medications again, you can introduce more points where there could be errors in the system. The final thing I'd like to say is that the legislature in the last couple of years has either passed or considered legislation that would allow a return of medications other than from nursing homes. The Cancer Drug Repository Program, for example, that passed in 2005. I worked with Representative Rukavina on a bill that has a companion here in the House that would allow a mail-order pharmacy, perhaps in another state, to deliver the medications to an in-state pharmacy so it could be repackaged and given to a patient in a nursing home who's forced to get the medications from the mail order pharmacy as a way to save money for that patient. In both of those instances, the legislation was written to have an informed consent so that the people who would end up getting the medications that were redispensed would know it. There's nothing in this law that would allow that. So in essence, what could happen is pharmacies could accept returns of medications from jails, redispense them to members of the public, and the public would not know about this at all. And with that, I would conclude my testimony and stand for questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Weiberg, would this bill be more acceptable to the Board of Pharmacy if it was limited to returns of blister pack medications?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it would be more acceptable if it specified that it was unit dose, board-approved unit dose packaging. Yes, it would be more acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can ask Senate Counsel to draft an amendment to that order.
Further questions? Ms. Brewington.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll also remind you that they work under the license of the nurse who's working there. So the nurses are usually very fastidious, you know, in terms of making sure that everything has happened. And, again, I'll remind you that all these medications are meds that the inmates would be giving themselves if they were at home or under house arrest. And we'd be happy with the unit dose amendment that Senator Berlin has offered. And just to remind you again, all the medications, whether they're even over-the-counter medications, are kept in a locked, limited-accessed, video-accessed surveillance system.
Senate Counsel, Senator Berglund's amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 6, after the word drugs, insert in-unit dose packaging.
Senator Berglund moves that amendment. Is there any discussion? Mr. Weiberg, is that language, I know it didn't address all your concerns, but is that language the right way to phrase it at least?
Mr. Chairman, what I would suggest is board approved unit dose packaging.
Approved unit dose packaging?
Board approved.
Board approved unit dose packaging.
There are many different types of unit dose systems out there, some better than others.
Senator Berglund moves line 6 of the amendment of the delete everything. In board-approved unit dose packaging. Further discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill? Mr. Weiberg.
If I might respond to the response. It is true, in fact, that the board withdrew its intention to establish a rule to note that pharmacies that returned medications or accepted returns from medications from nursing facilities would have to notify the public that they were doing so. But remember, we never contemplated in that rule package as originally written that returns from jails would be allowed. So when the governor expressed his concern, our understanding at the time is we were still talking about nursing homes, licensed nursing facilities, and not unlicensed non-health care facilities.
It's a mistake.
Senator Lori.
Yes, Mr. Weiberg. I do have one question, Mr. Chair. This whole thing is permissive, right? I mean, it is up to the individual pharmacist whether or not to accept it. It needs no rationale or anything. So, I mean, if we have a jail that or something that isn't bringing back something that is completely acceptable to a board-trained pharmacist, it's just permissive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you? I mean, does it?
Dr. Weber?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lori, it is permissive. What I can tell you is that there is intense competition among the pharmacies that are involved in long-term care, providing services to long-term care facilities or related facilities, pharmacies that, in fact, dispense in unit dose containers. There are indeed some local pharmacies that do that. I worked at some myself in Red Wing. But there are also a lot of large national and regional chains that like to go after these contracts. And although it's permissive, I can tell you from some of the materials that have been forwarded to me, and I'm not sure how they were obtained, but there were communications between particular counties and particular pharmacies trying to get their bids. And And for some of those pharmacies, it's almost become something of a marketing tool. We will accept these returns for you.
Senator Gorey.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Weiberg, is the jail or juvenile facility considered a long-term care that is also subject to that same competition? You said that there's large competition for the long-term care facilities, and I'm just wondering,
yeah.
I mean, these are short-term offenders, largely.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, what's basically happened is the pharmacies that specialize in long-term care have been branching out to other areas. They originally, when I started in this business, it was nursing homes, then assisted care facilities, group residential housing, and now jails. So they've expanded their scope because they have the equipment they need to do unit dose packaging. And so I don't believe, I'm not an expert on jails, but I don't believe they're considered long-term, you know, licensed long-term care health facilities. But the pharmacies are are trying to branch out and get some business. And there may be some reciprocal thing going on. Maybe the counties, some counties also were looking for some other solution than whatever they had.
Thank you.
Further discussion from the committee? If not, anybody else in the audience need to speak to this? If not, Senator Erickson Ropes moves Senate File 1959 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
All right.
Senator Berglund, Senate File 475.
Two-thirds of the way done.
Two-thirds? I thought you were done.
Two-thirds of the way done.
That's it. Oh, okay. Yes.
This is going to be a two-minute, right?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Worgan.
I think we all look at the authors on bills, and then we kind of think, I'm looking at the string of authors on this bill, and I'm thinking there's got to be something good because this is quite a combination.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It also is five of the members of the committee, so it's...
So can we just pass the bill now, Mr. Chair?
I think there might be some controversy in some...
But don't we have a majority of the committee that are authors?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is an issue that I've worked on for a number of years, and it came to my attention because originally... And I'm just going to give a little bit of history because there are quite a few new people here. Originally, we had a radiation oncology facility come in and be built right across the street from a hospital in St. Paul that already had a radiation oncology facility in their hospital. And this was of great concern. And... The facility hadn't actually filed the paperwork that they were supposed to file with the Department of Health, so then they were prohibited for 5 years from doing any more projects in Minnesota. During that time, there was intense debate in the legislature about the best way to deal with the issue. And there were bills to have kind of a certificate of need review on future facilities. There were bills to prohibit self-referral. There were bills to do a number of things. And finally, we hit on something that seemed to work both in the Senate and in the House at that time. And it was a bill you have before you, which would prohibit a facility from creating one of these facilities unless it was owned, operated, or controlled by a hospital. And the idea was that patients in the hospital need to use these facilities. People in the community need to use these facilities. There's no sense in creating a bunch of duplicative facilities because these facilities are very, very, very expensive to build in the millions of dollars, probably over $5 million.
We have conversations outside, please. Thanks. Continue, please.
And so if you build more of them than you need, you're really wasting healthcare dollars, in other words. I have handouts for you about the number of facilities we have in Minnesota. There's a comprehensive list of many, and if it hasn't been handed out, maybe it could be.
Yeah, they are.
Okay. So we have a comprehensive list, and then we have facilities that have been built since the law that I mentioned has been passed. And so you can see that there's a variety of ownership, a variety of places that they've been built, and certainly the law that we have has been working. The bill that I introduced is simply a bill that would remove the sunset on the law. And, of course, sunsetting the law would mean people could build as many facilities as they wanted wherever they wanted, and I just don't think that that's a very good policy to go forward with. Well, since the time I introduced the bill, other issues about this have come to light. And so if Senator Saltzman can come to the table and just talk a little bit about concerns she has in her community.
Senator Seligman, welcome to the committee. Thank you. Senator Seligman, did you have an amendment you wanted to?
I have an A5 amendment in the packet that could be distributed. And
while this being distributed, and before you explain it, then perhaps we had several questions or comments. Senator Erickson-Ropes and Senator Coring, and then Senator Oregon, did you have your hand up too?
No.
Sir Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Berglund, Senator Saltzman, for bringing this to us today. I'm going to quote something that Senator Dahl and I both said as we were out door knocking. Health care is not a commodity. We need to find a way to provide health care that makes enough profit that we can keep the system going so it doesn't implode on itself. It has to be a profit-making venture, but it doesn't need to be an exorbitant profit-making venture. And health care is not a commodity just to be sold to the highest bidder, people that have money to pay for it. And if you can get more money, you keep raising the prices and getting as much money as you can. And Senator Saltzman, I mentioned to you that I have this argument with my husband, who is a physician specialist all the time, and he happens to be a member of the other party. And he is one of these physician specialists who happens to bring in a lot of money to his hospital. And we have conversations all the time about how his specialty cross-subsidizes some of the other departments in the hospital. And I say, but honey, it has to work that way. Otherwise, if you split off and all the people that make the high-end dollars, you know, move off into their own little centers, who in the world, in their right mind, is going to go into just family practice? Who's going to want to take care of the colds and the hangnails and the thumbs that you slam in the car door? There's got to be people in the system that get compensated enough for general practice or for specialty areas that don't generate a ton of money. And within a whole system, yes, there's some cross-subsidizing going on. So I very much appreciate you bringing this concern to us. No one is against cancer treatment centers or people being treated for cancers, but we have to look underneath that at what is driving profits, what's driving the health care costs, and I thank you for bringing this to us today so we can have a discussion about it.
Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just want to just be on record as supporting Senator Berglund. Obviously, I'm an author on the bill, but in support of this amendment. Really, what we have here, members, and I think we can plainly see what it is what happens is, you know, it's cherry picking. I guess that's what I would call it, where they certainly would like to do take the most profitable things away from the hospital. I'll give cite you a quick example, members. Up in Brainerd, the doctors decided that they want to build a surgical center, and so then all the surgeries, the inpatient, where the person would come in and have a surgery and would come out the same day, that surgery would no longer happen at my local hospital, at St. Joseph's Hospital. And so really that would really take a lot of the profitability away from the hospital. And they were able, thank God, between the doctors and the hospital to work out so that the hospital was actually part owner in the surgical center too. So they weren't, they're losing profitability, but they're not losing as much. So members, what all this is doing is we're trying to protect our hospitals from the cherry picking of taking the most profitable things away from the hospital. So really what you want to do is you want to support this, because if you're supporting your hospitals, you want to support this. Did that make any sense?
Mr. Chairman, I understand that there are some concerns of a couple of members on the committee about limiting this amendment to Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, Dakota, Washington, Carver, or Anoka counties. And so because of that concern, we could just delete that, starting on lines 1.9 at the word in through the rest of that line. And then I think Senate Counsel would suggest that we add an effective date.
When did you want the effective date to be?
Well, usually if we don't have...
Right, it's August 1st.
If we don't have one, then we... I mean, if we don't have one and we want one, then we put day after enactment.
I don't know if she needs to say
that. Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chair and members, the effective date would read the day following final enactment. This section is effective the day following final enactment.
you want to incorporate those two changes into your AE5 amendment?
Well, I think it would meet the needs of the concerns of the committee better if we do that.
Discussion of in the amendment, I think people have been reading what it said while we were hearing it. Did you have any more comments on the amendment before we have more questions and testimonies? Senator Fischbach, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, actually, Senator Berglund addressed it, so.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund and Senator Saltzman, I'm very supportive of the underlying bill, but I'm looking at the amendment, and I have some questions about the amendment. Number one, I'm not entirely sure what item one is actually trying to say. It's a little bit confusing.
Senator Saltzman.
Mr. Chair, the other question that I have, this is really tight, okay? And it does do some prevention of new cancer treatment facilities coming up. The idea that they have to be have a working arrangement with the hospitals, I really understand. Here's a little bit of the questions that I have. Are these facilities coming, are any cancer facilities coming into being? I'm not sure how to word the question, Mr. Chair. Do we have too many facilities to handle the appointments, or do we have people waiting to get their appointments because we could use more facilities? In other words, you got to wait 6 weeks to get a physical. If you need cancer treatment, do you have to wait because there's not enough facilities to do the treatment?
Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, that's why I handed out the list to you. I certainly feel like there are way enough facilities in the metro area. I'm not an expert on the other parts of the state, but this doesn't prohibit facilities from being built in either part of the state. The latest facility that's being built in rural Minnesota is in Worthington, and you'll notice on the list it's a consortium of five hospitals. One hospital has a controlling interest, and the other four have a 49% interest. So it wouldn't prohibit that kind of thing from happening. So I think there's still flexibility here, but it would not really, you know, allow a facility to be built in the name of a partnership with a hospital across the street from a competing hospital.
Mr. Chair, here's kind of the deal. Bringing it home. I have a sister whose cancer is in remission, and she has finished her chemotherapy for now. I have a nephew who 2 weeks ago was diagnosed with cancer and needs a lot of treatment. Are there enough facilities so that those people who need those appointments don't have to wait to get appointments for treatment, or will this inhibit that in any way?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I don't think it will inhibit the development of needed facilities at all, and I think certainly in the metro area there is no waiting lists and no problem getting into a facility. You can see the number we have, and you can see how many of them and where they are, and certainly in outstate areas, it only makes sense that a facility be built with the hospital because, you know, the hospital patients need to use it also. And this amendment doesn't disallow that from happening.
Mr. Chair, what other what other medical services do we limit to a point where it has to be a nonprofit corporation that will derive at least 90% of the benefit of the facility? Do we have any other such thing in existence?
Senator Bergwin?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I don't know of any, but I'm not necessarily the expert on it. I don't know of any, but I know this is the area that we've had the most difficulty with this kind of thing happening.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Senator Wergen.
Senator Berglund, number one on your amendment takes care of a lot of things. Why is number two necessary?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, number two would allow another hospital. Let's just say, well, I don't know. Let me look at the list here and see.
Princeton.
What's not on the list? I mean, maybe if somebody wanted to build a facility, let's just say in
Princeton, maybe.
Yeah.
Good town.
You know, I don't know if there's a hospital in Princeton.
There is, Madam Chair. Fairview North.
Let's just say they wanted to build a facility there. They felt they had enough market share. They had the physicians that wanted to staff it. So they wanted to do that. Number two would allow that to happen.
In other words, Senator, we're going to, the hospital could do it. You couldn't have a private business come in and a for-profit business come in and with ownership of it, more than 10% of it, and build it. That was what the problem is. If you look at the front page, that some of them were building right across the street from coming in. Senator Hand and Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the underlying bill, Senator Berglund, I think I understand some of the history of why that was done, and I think I can accept the deletion of the sunset and say let's go forward on that basis, but I'm very troubled by the amendment, frankly, because it seems to me what we're saying is that radiation therapy facilities can be built as long as they're built by nonprofits. But for-profit corporations can't do that. And I don't understand why we would have a prejudice against for-profit entities entering the healthcare marketplace, why we would arbitrarily say let's limit facilities and only allow nonprofit organizations to build them. And I guess the question then would be, apparently there's some bias against profit-making in the medical field, but even nonprofits make some money. I mean, they've got to somehow finance what they're going to do, so whether they call it profitability or, you know, there's been some questions about nonprofits' finances and how they manage that. But isn't the intent of this to say that these facilities can be built as long as they're built by nonprofit entities?
Okay. Senator Salzman.
About this, and you change this law in 2 years.
Before we debate further on this, I wonder, I'm just curious, I think there might be some witnesses. I have only one listed, but wonder if people who wish to testify could raise your hand so we get a sense of how many people have it. Is there one? One? Two? Two people. Okay. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, really, number two kind of goes along with the main bill because the hospitals in Minnesota are not-for-profit. So, you know, really the not-for-profit corporation we're talking about here is a hospital.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
And Senator Berglund, I understand that so, and I appreciate that. And my only point is that, and I guess to Senator Saltzman, your point, frankly, I don't know that my main concern is which entity benefits or drives the revenue from the activity. My concern is where do Minnesota citizens get the best and most cost-effective health care? And if these facilities that are operated, I guess, presumably by private entities, provide a good service at a better cost to consumers than a hospital, then I don't want to insert my judgment into this and say, well, no, you can't do it. The trouble I have is you came in and said this is the expert. I'm not an expert. This is my first year on the committee even, and I don't feel that I'm at all an expert in healthcare. I get very uncomfortable saying that my judgment is so broad and expansive that I understand all these things so well that I can make decisions about which entities ought to be in place and which ones shouldn't and where they ought to be and how much money they should make. All those questions I'm very ignorant of, and I don't feel I'm qualified to make those decisions for everybody in the state of Minnesota. I think we ought to be looking at how do we move this whole marketplace into a direction where costs are clear and consumers can make informed decisions. And I'm not sure that putting this sort of prohibition on these helps us get at that question of understanding where costs are and who provides the best service.
Senator Berglund, and then if committee members don't mind, I'd like to have the testimony then, and then we can continue. Senator Pretner, so when you went.
My hand was raised also.
I understand. Senator Berglund and Senator Pretner-Solon and then the witnesses, if that's okay with people. I know there are plenty of questions over here yet.
Mr. Chair.
And
over here.
Just a question to you. Have we adopted the amendment? Are the testifiers on the amendment? Should we deal with that first and then the whole bill? I'm just wondering.
Senator
process.
Berglund, as the author, wishes that to be added as an author's amendment, we could do that, and then I have a feeling that's what the debate's going to be about and the witnesses will be as well. But Senator Pretner-Solon?
Mr. Chair, I'd really like an opportunity to ask questions about the amendment before we adopted it because I'd like to support the bill.
Okay. Senator Berglund, as an author, you can push this as an author's amendment or you can, which generally means we just put it on. Otherwise, if you would prefer to not treat it that way, it's up to you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer questions about the amendment. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, you said you support the underlying bill, and the underlying bill does require facilities to be in partnership with a hospital, which are nonprofit. The organization that is in partnership with a hospital doesn't necessarily have to be a nonprofit. And the amendment doesn't require the organization that's in partnership to necessarily be a nonprofit. The nonprofit here that we're referring to in number two would be the hospital. And if that needs to be clarified further, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to clarify that language.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm a little confused then because, Senator Saltzman, your testimony seemed to say that there were for-profit entities that were doing these things, even though, Senator Berglund, as you point out, and as the current law says, that all these have to be in partnership with a nonprofit. So if that's the case, what's the concern? Is it the concern that these partnerships are...
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hunt, I will be just very blunt, if you don't mind.
No, but I'm trying to understand the issue here. It's
when we passed this law, we never thought a hospital would be in partnership with another organization at the expense of another hospital.
Sir Bergen, I think he's not aware of what was happening before the law was passed last time.
Well, I did explain that at the beginning of the hearing.
No, I think I...
Okay.
So, you know, we thought we had taken care of the original kind of situation, because we never thought a hospital would be in partnership with an organization and buy land and build across the street from a competing hospital. We now have that situation in Senator Saltzman's district. So apparently there's enough money in this for everybody, so, you know, we can actually, you know, not worry about our neighbors and our other hospitals in our community. We can just go ahead and try and expand our market base in spite of that. And that's what's going on. So that was the reason for number two in the amendment. And, you know, the not-for-profit corporation referred to here is the hospital, to make sure that we're not letting a hospital buy land on behalf of a corporation where the corporation is the main organization that's profiting from it, even though the other hospital might have some gain to be made.
You want to keep going with questions before we get the testimony? Okay. Senator Pretner Solon was next.
Okay. Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Senator Berglund or Senator Saltzman, I agree with the intent of what you're expressing. I'm just not certain or maybe don't trust that this really does that, and I am concerned that there might be some unintended consequences. First of all, with the word relocation, unless it has a different definition, I'm concerned that if a hospital wanted to develop a radiation facility that was across the street, that it would not be able to because it was not already a radiation facility that was in place. It would not be a relocation of that facility. It would be a new radiation facility, although associated with that hospital. And then the second thing is I have concerns with a nonprofit corporation, not because I care it's a nonprofit corporation, but what stops another nonprofit hospital operating a facility across the street from an existing hospital? It seems like that would permit that.
Senator Berglund, Senate Council has possible language for that, tightening that up to the hospital. Senate Council.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it would work if on line 13 you delete a nonprofit corporation and say the hospital will derive, understanding that it's the hospital that is being partnered with in paragraph A.
Senator Berglund, did you want to incorporate that into the amendment with the other changes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Pretner, so on.
And then, Mr. Chair, could I have an opinion about relocation?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pretner Solon, we've got two kinds of situations here. The first is to take care of existing facilities that might not want to rebuild right on the same parcel of land. The second is if a hospital doesn't have a facility. And it doesn't say where they necessarily would build that facility, but the intention is that they would be building that facility as a part of the original hospital. And I think, you know, somehow maybe we need some language to clarify that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm concerned that if you just read, if the first one doesn't apply, no radiation therapy facility may be constructed unless the hospital will derive at least 90% of the financial benefit of the facility. But it doesn't really specify which hospital would locate there. And I'm still not certain that it allows a current hospital to develop its own radiation facility within a mile.
It seems like you've got either or. Mm-hmm. The hospital can build one where it wants, as long as it controls at least 90% of the financial benefit.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, probably what we could do is we could add at the end of line 14, if the hospital has no existing radiation therapy facility. Would that make it clearer?
No, that would mean you couldn't build it if they... Well, that means the 90% limitation would only be on a hospital that didn't have any.
Right, but Senator Pretner Solon is concerned that somebody still might build a facility across the street from a competing hospital. And that wouldn't really happen if you had it limited to a hospital that didn't have a facility. And Senator Saltzman's hospital would be able to build a facility. Nobody else would be able to build one across the street from her hospital because they already would have one.
In other words, you, Senator Berglund, you could say that the hospital will derive at least 90% of the benefit of the facility and it's located within such and such distance of that hospital?
Well, distance isn't an issue in number two. It's just if the hospital has no existing radiation therapy facilities now. So if they've got one
of their own
hospital, they don't need to build one across from somebody else's hospital. If they don't have one, then they could go ahead and build
the hospital.
Could you tell, when it comes to the language you were envisioning?
So at the end of line 14, before the period insert, if the hospital has no existing radiation therapy facility.
Say it again.
At the end of line 15, before the period, if the hospital has no existing radiation therapy facility.
Mr. Chair?
I don't know.
Senator, I didn't see who said that.
Me.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, maybe the problem is that we're doing this in the negative. Maybe what we should say is a hospital may construct a radiation therapy facility if it complies with these things. You know, that it currently doesn't have a radiation therapy unit, or if it is relocating a facility within an existing or within a mile of an existing one, or if the hospital will derive. Maybe the problem is that we've got it all twisted up sentence-wise.
Should we take testimony while Senate Counsel takes a look at this? I have Dr. Bob Beck is the only one listed, but I know there is somebody else who wished to testify as well. So, Dr. Beck, welcome to the committee, and then the other person can be ready next. Welcome to the committee. Just please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you.
see it one more time. See if we can.
Thank you, Dr. Beck. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Beck, or Dr. Beck, a question for you is on, are you telling us that really it's a really unlevel playing field is really what we're trying to talk about here? Now, I've heard some conversations on this over the past few months, and I know this has been going on for some time. Now, is it also that the doctors within the hospital are doing a lot of referrals to these organizations, or is that not the case? The doctors within your hospital or in a hospital where this may happen, I'm hearing that from the normal procedure here is that doctors within a hospital refer because they have an interest in that outside location. Mm-hmm. Is that what you've heard as well, or is that not the case? Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. If the other witness is ready to testify. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Flynn. I am an oncologist practicing here in the Twin Cities, representing Minnesota Oncology Hematology, which is a private practice made up of 40 cancer specialists practicing here in 8 locations in the greater metropolitan area. I've been practicing oncology here in Minnesota since 1981. My partners and I, all specialists in cancer care, feel that the best model of care delivery is an integrated model of care delivery in the community. 85% of cancer care is delivered in an outpatient setting. That's data from the Centers for Disease Control, and it has been that way for quite a number of years, actually. Integrated care facilities bring cancer specialists from various parts of the cancer treatment team together to focus on the cancer patient. We have medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and gynecologic oncologists. A facility which brings those professionals together provides very convenient, easy-to-access care for cancer patients. Usually the facility will have drive-up access. These patients are often, particularly when going through treatment, very weak, very ill, and not in a position to comfortably negotiate through multiple facilities to get imaging testing in one place and radiation in another place and medical oncology in another place. So we feel this model of care is ideal. It is also very professionally satisfying. There's an opportunity for professional interaction that doesn't occur as readily in other situations. There is a study published in the Journal of Oncology Practice, which is published by our National American Society of Clinical Oncology, that has demonstrated in a facility in California that development of a center like this resulted in improved survivals of their patient population compared to what was occurring prior to the implementation of that center. So we feel that's the best model of care, and we are very motivated to try to deliver that care model to as many patients as can possibly benefit from it. We see any patient who comes through our door. We don't pre-select individuals based on their ability to pay. And we certainly have a large amount of non-compensated care that we do deliver within our practice. We believe that there is additional need, and the facility that we are partnering with Allina to develop in Woodbury, we believe, is needed. There are some models for analyzing the need for linear accelerators in a given population. It comes from two other states that have models to analyze that, and by that analysis, it appears there's a need for at least one more center, not considering the fact that the baby boomers are obviously increasing in number, and the incidence of cancer is increases with age, and therefore the increased need will be there. So we think that the there is not overcapacity, certainly by any means, in the current setting, and we feel this facility would bring additional value to the community, and we are prepared to do this and very experienced and capable of doing so, we think, in a matter that will provide a very high quality care. We do have a relationship with U.S. Oncology. U.S. Oncology is a national network of oncology practices. There are over 900 oncologists who are part of that network, each in their own, not each, but I mean all the physicians are in a private practice setting, not employed by U.S. Oncology, not told how to practice, certainly, by U.S. Oncology. They provide a number of things which we think enhance our ability to deliver care. They are the developers of a very robust clinical trials network, which has been responsible for pivotal studies in the development of a dozen drugs in the cancer treatment area that have come to FDA approval in the last several years. We also have established a charitable foundation through our practice, a separate 501c3 corporation, the Angel Foundation, which provides support groups, provides actually financial support to patients going through treatment if they have difficulty in meeting their mortgage or rent payments or need support for being able to buy food. There's also a program within that foundation which is focused on the children of individuals with cancer, and that is a very unique program in the community. So we see U.S. Oncology as value-added and something which enables us to deliver care at a better level than we could on our own. The physicians in my practice provide services in hospitals in the Health East system, in the Allina system, in the Fairview system. We also have physicians in Waconia. And we have physicians available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to see patients in the hospital who need that, who need oncology or hematology care. We do not send all of our patients who need radiation therapy to our current center in Maplewood or the center that we are partnering with Allina on in at United. We did an analysis of this a few years ago, and I don't think it has changed significantly. 60% of our patients receive their radiation therapy at facilities that we have no financial interest in. We send them to where they need to go based on the treatment they need and based on the geographic convenience of where they can easily, most easily access that treatment. The hospital coverage issue, as I indicated, is something that we do provide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. One of my partners last weekend was called upon to see a patient at a Health East facility where the Health East employed oncologist could not be located, and there was no oncologist to see the patient. So in the midst of an already very busy weekend covering the patients within our practice, she also took over and assisted management of that patient in the hospital. In summary, we believe that another facility is needed. We believe that the integrated model of care provides the ideal delivery system for cancer patients. It is capable of providing convenient access governmental payers in many settings actually reimburse at a lower level for those facilities than they do for hospital-based facilities. We think that the issues here really are about access to care, and we must remember always that the primary focus here should be what is best for the patients that we care for. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Senator Corin.
Mr. Chairman, just kind of inquiring, are we waiting on to get this amendment squared away?
Senate Counsel has some language she was getting typed up or getting copied at least.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I think as soon as we get that amendment, I think the members are pretty familiar with this bill, and I think we're ready to vote. I know I'm ready to vote here, Senate Counsel. And I would just say that, you know, Senator Berglund is in her 35th year here, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sorry. That was a compliment.
She must have been a teenager when she started that.
No, I think if Senator Berglund, I think Senator Berglund knows this issue very well, members, and so, you know, that was meant as a compliment. It really was, Senator Berglund. And I just think we know what this is, and I think we're ready to wrap it up.
So after discussion of the A5 amendment, I think we're on now an A8 amendment.
A8 amendment, which is incorporated, it's being handed out now, and people can look it over.
So I would move adoption of the amendment to put it before
Senator Berglund moves
chairman.
The adoption of the A8 amendment. Senator,
and then the A5 has went away.
This is what A5 morphed into, I guess.
Okay. So the A5 is, Mr. Chairman, A5
is
never adopted.
It was never adopted.
So I've just withdrawn.
This did not have the effective date, though.
Right, we need an effective date.
We can put the effective date back in. This section is effective on the day following final enactment. Senator Worgen, did you have a question or comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's probably more of a comment than anything. We all have our bottom lines when we're talking about various issues, and I'm going to admit that. I don't think it's a bad thing. I got to say that my bottom line on this whole thing, and at this point I'm confused, my bottom line on this whole thing is whether or not people like my nephew recently diagnosed with cancer, whether he'll get the best possible care at the best possible price in a good facility. And I'll be very blunt in saying, at this point in time, I don't have a clue whether this amendment does that or not. I think the underlying bill does.
Mr. Chairman,
not sure what I think. I just want everybody in this room to know that that's got to be the bottom line.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Worgen, this amendment does not prohibit new facilities from being built. What it does is it says that the new facilities that are built, the hospital that is the base organization creating the new facility has to have 90% of the financial benefit from the facility. And I think that was what we intended, more or less, with the underlying bill. You know, we thought it was going to primarily benefit the hospitals to, you know, have these facilities created in partnership with them.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Senator Saltzman came to us because we are policymakers for this body. And let me suggest that if we are in a position that we support policies that permit the fracturing of our hospitals in this state, we will have a much larger problem than what is presented to us tonight. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the adoption of the A8 amendment.
Okay. Senator Berglund may have, or Senator Lynch offers the A8 amendment. And the A and the B would be deleted from it as well. Is there a discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund moves Senate File 475 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. I told people we'd be out of here before 7 o'clock, and we are.
Thank you.
That meeting's adjourned. Yep.